Good evening and welcome to this meeting of the Expanded Budget Committee. We have 8 legislators present, combined in chambers and remotely, so I think we can get going. I do not have any introductory comments of any kind, so we can move directly to planning and tourism. DPS's material is available on page 4-165 of your book, and tourism promotion is on page 4-208. So is Katie here? Yes.
All yep, right. I'm here.
Take it away, Katie.
All right. Let's see if I can share my screen. Okay, I think I'm all set. You all ready for me now?
Yes, and we can see your screen. Thank you.
Wonderful. Great. So just want to start out that the department's budget largely consists of salary and fringe for the 11-person staff that we have. And I think you're all well aware we work on a wide range of planning topics with various expertise and responsibilities. Each year, we administer and implement many different grant programs and over-target requests, which always makes it difficult to compare our budgets year over year. So you can see in the recommended 2022 budget showing a 5.6% decrease from the 2021 modified budget. That really, again, is just due to over-target requests and budget adjustments that were made over the course of 2021. A couple things I wanted to.
We're still on the first slide. I don't know if we're supposed to be advancing.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay.
Point. Thank you. There. Sorry about that. I wanted just to kind of give some overview of what these numbers represent. And I wanted to highlight a couple things in our base budget that aren't necessarily readily apparent in this high-level figure. But I did want to note that we normally we budget for $15,000 in revenues and $15 in expenses under a county line called County Forestry. And we have zeroed that out in 2022. Just as a way to simplify accounting, and given the recent positions taken by the legislature on forest management, it seems like we probably don't need those right now. And if we do identify forestry work in the future, we would bring a request directly to the legislature for funding those activities. Again, we included $5,500 in our budget for grant writing assistance for 2022. That's the second year we've done that. In 2021, we had $4,000 allocated for that use. We wound up transferring that to the health department so that they could hire somebody to put together their successful CDBG septic system replacement program. And we also just wanted to note that we are increasing the hourly cost of our circuit rider program, now called municipal planning assistance, raising it from $24 to $26 per hour. That represents the halftime of a planner's work, and the last increase was 3 years ago, but wanted to highlight that for people. And in terms of the next slide, the full-time equivalents, there's one more position in there that has to do with the over-target request for the chief sustainability officer position, which was placed in the county administrator's budget in 2021 and was transferred to our department. It also, that little 0.15 FTE, just during discussions with Kevin McGuire leaving, actually, we realized that we had not been recording our project assistance correctly on this form, so that's showing some project assistant help as well. In terms of the over target requests, we've got quite a few of them for you this year. Deborah, did you want me to talk through each one of these with questions after each one, or give kind of high level of all of them? Which would you prefer?
Well, I think you could give a high level of each one, and if people have questions, they're going to have to just sing out, because I can't see hands raised on Zoom as long as we're sharing your screen, but that's okay. I mean, I don't think you have to go through them in depth. For example, you've already explained the transfer of the chief sustainability officer. Now, some of them are really self-explanatory, like computer equipment and let's see.
Sure. I could take a stab at just being quick and some high-level comments.
Yeah, I think the book does a pretty good job of explaining them.
Yeah, I don't want to reread the book to you. That's
no doubt.
I did want to just note with the OTR number 19, Chief Sustainability Officer, I was kind of surprised putting this presentation together that Terry's only been with us for 3 months. Terry Carroll started in mid-June, and since then he's done a tremendous job working with ARRAL on green facilities planning, with purchasing electric vehicles. He's been doing a lot of work with NYSEG on online billing to simplify and improve the county's billing process, working with Jonathan, understanding our renewable energy credits. So I think that position, from my view at least, has shown tremendous value already. Broadband expansion, I did want to talk a little bit about this. We did speak with the Housing and Economic Development Committee last week, and have been working with Martha on scheduling a special meeting of HED next week before the legislature meets. And we do have a resolution and a memo bringing kind of a path forward for broadband to HED and the legislature next week. We put this OTR in, honestly, as kind of a placeholder, just recognizing that it's been identified as a high priority, and there may be need for consulting assistance for applying for grant funding or providing some other type of technical expertise to expand broadband access. The OTR number 32, traffic calming and control, that comes right out of the Reimagining Public Safety report, and that was an item that was DPS was identified as playing a key role, and we thought it would be wonderful to start on that work as soon as possible. And so this would be to work with some sort of consultant engineering firm, probably, to help identify traffic calming measures that could be assessed for high traffic areas and areas with frequent traffic stops as a way to reduce the need for interaction between the public and public safety.
Katie, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
What do you know what traffic areas those would be? Would those be mostly in the city, or those also be in the county too?
It's looking countywide, yeah. So yes, okay. It would be both.
Okay. Thanks.
Can I jump in for a second, Katie? The in the book it says the cost for this will be shared with the city, and I think we've had this question before, and I'm never quite clear about with the reimagining stuff. Is the number in our book the full number that we'll be paying, and then the city will also pay that amount, or?
Yeah, the total cost of the project is $160,000, so each entity is being asked for $80,000.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, and just so you know, that figure was based roughly on the Route 13 study because it was somewhat similar in scope and identifying particular areas that might need additional design work. We hope that's the right figure, but we'll find out when we put out a request for proposals.
Katie, I have a couple questions. It's Martha. So in the book, it says 160,000 one time. Oh, and is that, but then minus 80. So is that presumably revenue of 80 from the city for a cost applied to a cost of 160?
Right, correct.
Okay. Why wouldn't this be in ITCTC? I would think, I know you have talked at, you know, in at various times about even if planning is just sort of bird dogging a consultant, you know, supporting and working with a consultant that's doing the main work, that takes away planning time from other things. And I'm not sure this is deeply in planning's wheelhouse as much as it might be under ITCTC.
I think it's honestly, again, it's kind of modeled on the Route 13 study where ITCTC and DPS worked closely on it together and shared responsibilities and both reviewed and managed it. And that worked pretty well, I think, with the Route 13 study. It just, ITCTC does not have very many staff people to help out with an effort like this. And I thought it was important that we step up to the plate and try to move this forward. Fernando's been involved in all of the discussions to date, and of course he and his staff would be helping out with data and management of the project.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Hello, Katie.
Hi, Henry.
Hi, because I was reading the book that this would focus on existing data, and it will focus on low-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods with a high penetration, high proportion of racial ethnic minorities, and also bicyclists and tourists. And so, again, isn't this mostly just the city, or is this also the county?
Well, I think part of the issue, this initiative won't probably start until later in 2022, because the beginning part of 2022, from my understanding, is trying to collect the data that we would need to base the study on, which it's not necessarily clear how that data is going to appear to us. I'm not sure it's currently being collected in a perfect way that we could use it very well. So we don't really know the scope of exactly where this work will be occurring until we're able to look at the traffic violation data and the other data that will form the base of this project. We'll look at the whole county, but indeed it may turn out that the focus will be in the city, but we can't really definitively answer that question until we have more data.
Okay, yes, that's what I'm wondering, whether we should go 50-50 with the city on this. But okay. Thank you.
I think that ship's already sailed. So.
Well, we can revisit ships too.
Let's move on. I think that decision is above Katie's pay grade. So.
Okay.
Great. I can talk about computer equipment if you'd like me to.
No, I'd like to talk about county membership dues.
All right. Okay. So, computer equipment, I think, is pretty straightforward, but I'm happy to answer questions if people have them. OTR number 22, Municipal Housing Affordability and Infrastructure Fund. This is the third year of a three-year OTR begun in 2019. It showed great promise in 2019. It did not thrive during the pandemic, including us zeroing out the funding. So this year, I will say we have not gotten any applications yet. We have tried to, email announcements at TCOG meetings, et cetera. I think everybody's just pretty overwhelmed with everything on their plate right now. I would love to see this continued another year just to see if we can get it going again. And there's also, potential for new federal funds coming down the pike that this amount of money may help some municipalities be more competitive in accessing those funds. We do have an open round right now with a deadline of November 1st. There have been a couple municipalities who have expressed some interest, but it's unclear whether anyone will apply for it or not this year. Okay, OTR 23, the county membership's dues increases. So this OTR is for memberships that serve the entire county organization, but they're paid for through Department of Planning and Sustainability's budget. And I do want to highlight that while the total increase in dues from 2021 levels for these organizations is $7,349 for 2022, two of the organizations, CUIO, the Watershed Intermunicipal Organization, and ST8, the Regional Planning Board, are proposing three-year phase-ins of dues increases. So next year, we would anticipate coming to you with an over-target request to our target budget for dues increases of another $5,274. And then the next year, we would then again come for a target increase of another $4,474 for the 2024 budget. So the total increase for all three organizations from 2021 to 2024 is projected to be around $17,000.
Katie, that is a huge increase for the intermunicipal organization in terms of percentages. What is the reason for that, looking at over the 4 years?
Sure. So they are trying to raise enough money to hire a watershed coordinator who could write and administer grants and do education and do a lot of the work for the watershed, which is so large. I will say that the dues calculation for CUIO is based on acreage in the watershed, miles of shoreline, taxable assessed value, and population density. And Tompkins County makes up 43% of the Cayuga Lake watershed. So it makes it so that Tompkins County needs to pay much more money than it currently is, obviously, in this new formula.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add, Katie, that Liz Thomas came and did a presentation to Peak about this, and I actually wouldn't mind if they went faster in increasing this. This is going to allow them to hire somebody for a contract person to do limited hours and eventually work up to a full-time person to do this. And I am definitely in favor of doing anything we can to help the lake. And this has been something this organization and other organizations have been wanting to figure out for several years, many years, to figure out how to get a full-time person to coordinate with the different municipalities in the watershed. So I'm glad you included this in your OTR.
This is Amanda. I would also just jump in quickly as the IO liaison person on their board. I think they're also really kind of starting to come into their own as their own organization. They recently, you know, revised and updated their bylaws. They've been looking at their whole structure and really trying to, get a little bit more on par with other IOs in the region, and like, you know, like has been said, like really trying to do more than just talk about things, hire somebody to be able to do some work to protect our watershed. So I think that they realize that it's a huge shift for several municipalities, but I do think it's worth it as well.
And Would this be in lieu of us hiring a watershed protector?
Henry, I would think it would be. You know, I was the liaison to the IO before Amanda, and it was my perception there were some really smart, caring people on the IO that represented the various municipalities and counties within the watershed. that they were all volunteers, and they were all people who had other jobs and other obligations. And without somebody on the payroll whose full-time job it is to coordinate efforts to protect the watershed, the organization really couldn't get anywhere.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And then the last OTR has to do with advisory board priorities. And again, we bring these to the legislature as your advisory boards to make a decision on these OTRs. The first one is from the Environmental Management Council, who is requesting $2,000 to continue their ongoing efforts to keep the inventory of unique natural areas up to date. I will highlight that, the recent Bell Station land was identified as a unique natural area. It is an important planning process and planning document. The second request is from the Water Resources Council, and they are requesting $695 for transportation. They have started doing these field visits for municipal officials to actually go out and see examples of stream buffer plantings and other water quality projects. And apparently it's been a great program in the past, and they'd like to keep the momentum going with that. So we can move on to the tourism program next. And I believe Nick is going to hop on and walk you through the tourism program.
Thanks, Katie. So yeah, I've got just a couple of slides here about the tourism program and our 2022 budget. This budget was drafted in collaboration with the Strategic Tourism Planning Board Budget Committee, a process that starts in the spring and was wrapped up at the June 16 meeting of STPB, where the advisory board voted to recommend this budget. The biggest noteworthy thing you'll see here is that this includes a over-target request for $655,247. This is in line with the proposal that Jason Molino outlined in the budget retreat back in April, and where this funding would be brought in to basically bring the tourism program room tax budget back to the original 2020 budget level, and allow us to reboot a lot of the programs that have been sort of at lower capacity over the last 2 years due to the pandemic. So the purpose of this OTR is to would be to fund our five of our core partners in the tourism program. That's the Convention Visitors Bureau for their destination marketing and visitor experience work. Cornell Cooperative Extension of Tompkins County for the community beautification work, Downtown Ithaca Alliance for their festivals program, and Hospitality Ambassadors, Community Arts Partnership for a variety of work they do related to the arts and assisting us with grants, and the Workforce Development Board. So the funds would be proportionally basically allocated amongst those partners. So one important, I think, noteworthy thing is that this would allow the CVB to operate for the entirety of 2020 at full capacity, restoring 1.5 full-time marketing positions and between 6 and 8 seasonal visitor staff at their visitor centers. So, real impacts there for both our visitors and for the community. Other than the OTR here, which is relatively noteworthy, that otherwise this tourism budget looks a lot similar to tourism budgets you may have seen in past years, 2019 or 2020. Other programs are basically in line with where they were in those budget years. With one exception, one new element that is in here is a outdoor recreation grant. We're tentatively calling the Tompkins Outdoors Grant. This would recognize that, local organizations that support outdoor recreation you know, they could benefit from funds that would support increasing their capacity and organizational development and helping us to really make sure that Ithaca and Tompkins County, you know, emerges as a premier destination for outdoor recreation within the region and across the country, frankly. So this is, you know, playing into some of our strengths as a destination. Otherwise, the other grants that you're familiar with, the Arts and Culture Organization Development Grant, Community Celebrations, Tourism Project Grants, Tourism Marketing Grants, and Tourism Capital Grants are all slated to return into the budget for 2022. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has regarding the proposal.
Does anyone have any questions?
Yes, I have a question for Lisa. This is definitely coming out of ARP funding.
That's where it's recommended to come from.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Martha here. Nick, does this bring, I think you said this brings the 2022 budget back to where it was in 2020 or where it would have been on the usual annual growth trajectory?
Basically where we 2020 started. Yeah, the original 2020 budget.
That's original 2020. So in a sense, 2 years worth of growth that we have usually seen, you're not expecting them.
That's correct. It's not, there's no, you know, trend line plotted in here to account for that.
Okay. Is that enough? I mean, I hate to ask somebody if that's enough. I mean, does that work?
It does work. It brings us, you know, it allows us to operate the programs that are central to this initiative. I don't think, right now the budget works as it is. I don't have any other, we could always use more money, but you know.
Right.
And so just can everyone else.
And just one other thing. You had, when we were talking about that OT, the contingent fund allocation back in the summer, you talked about the capital projects that there were some that were a lot that were kind of on hold and you just put a big pause on that. So do you foresee that there, you know, when we open this back up again, will there be, you know, a pent up demand for more with more capital applications or do you think it'll just be kind of a normal cycle?
That's a great question. I mean, if the Community Celebrations grant is in any indication, it's going to be closer to normal than like some big outrageous demand. And I think there are other factors that are sort of stressing organizations right now, that their ability to sort of get into new projects. So I think for whatever demands are out there, there's also some headwinds there we're facing as well. Still.
Okay. Got it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Is there anything else for Nick? All right then. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Nick. Keep up the good work. And we will be moving on to Cornell Cooperative Extension. Let's see. That is at page 5-6 of your book. And I'm sure Ken Schlauber's here somewhere.
I am.
Okay. Yeah, y'all look so tiny.
I am tiny. I've gotten smaller with COVID. I look there in the room and I see just a couple of people and I think, well, people decide not to attend the budget session, but I'm forgetting that there are people up in the top, as tiny as I am. So you want me to go ahead and share my screen?
Yes, that'd be good. Thanks.
Okay. And I will.
Perfect.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you all for letting me come and do this presentation. Thank you also for the support, for this past year. 20,000 plus people who participated in our programs last year or in 2021 so far, I think would, should thank you. But it's really been, I mean, it really is, it's been a tough year. It's been a tough year for everybody. It's been a tough year for you all, I'm sure. And it is just so nice to have had the kind of support that we've had from the county government. So really greatly appreciated. I did, you know, I put in or I arranged to have put in your, boxes today, hard copies of the 2020 annual report, which, just got printed. It is actually available electronically on our website if you want to take a look at that. So without further ado, we'll go right into things. One of the big, you know, one of the things that I'd had requests from the PEAK committee to do a little bit of discussion about, the county appropriation in relation to our overall budget. So I've put here, a slide that shows, the county appropriation, which is the bright yellow, against the green, which is the total budget. And I put in 2003 with 2020, which is the most recent full year, of course. Just so you get a sense of the growth of the association over the past few years. And I did put in the current revenue, or this is the revenue for 2020, with the basic category. So we've got, fees for service, which was almost 600,000, private contributions, donations, roughly 300,000, state and federal appropriation of 262. The county gave us 258 for our target appropriation. And then, grants and contracts, which lumped in there is also the PPP money, cause it is a contract, of 6.2 million. The two components that we have in the budget, and I do want to say that, you know, when you look at back at these numbers here, you know, a big part of, and since we're talking about the county appropriation, the association is, before I came here, had always thought in terms of taking what the county had provided to us and really using it to leverage other resources to expand programming beyond what the county appropriation would allow. And so back in 2003, that leveraging was 3-1. And in 2020, it's now roughly 10-1. So, back to the primary budget components, we really have in our total budget, we really have two sort of budget categories. And this was in that document that was shared that Ann Corman sent out, last week. But there are two basic, budget components. There's the program budgets, which are basically all of the grants and contracts, the fee for service programs. Those all get lumped into, an overall budget called the program budget, which also then combined with the operation budget comprises our total budget. So the operations budget in 2020 in 2021 is about 1.3 million, and the overall pie here is about $8 million. The county appropriation, just to give you again some context, so the operations budget has grown since 2003. It's roughly twice what it was, a little bit less than twice what it was in 2003. And that's, you know, the budget, overall budget has grown by about four times. So the operations budget has, there's some economies of scale. We should probably be putting more money in the operations budget. Shauna was just at a meeting that I was in just a few minutes ago where we were talking about some of that. But the part of the point here and the point of the next slide is, to also indicate that the appropriation from the county basically moves into, it's used in the operations budget. So all of the county appropriation moves into this $1.3 million operations budget, which is used, the expense categories, the basic expense categories are admin, facilities, and program. So the program in this case is the program leadership for the, so the leadership of the organization, and the contract, the regional agriculture contract that we have, where we, along with a number of other counties, buy into a team that, that allows us then to, have the expertise of six staff, who work with the commercial dairy and commercial field crop farms in our region. So they work with, and they work closely with our county-based agricultural staff to reach out to about 90% of the farmers in the county are connected, are part of our programming with the association. And I think I've shared this once before, but in case I didn't, the regional team plus our staff connected with it was like 280 farmers, I think, to help them get PPP loans. And so they brought in somewhere north of $25 million into those farms in the county through PPP loans, which all were forgiven. So the budget revenue for the operations budget consists of the county target, county appropriation, state and federal appropriation that we get. In 2021, we've used reserves as well. And then we have the second largest category is the indirect charges, which we call the program support fee or PSF. And those indirect charges are levied against grants and contracts and fee-for-service programs. As I said before, again, the expenses or the operations budget, which is where the county appropriation goes, covers these three major categories. This OTR is, so one of the things that we do with OTRs that are programmatic based or where there's a commitment on the part of the association for doing something. So for in 2020 and 2021, we were a pass-through for the Food Policy Council for their food system planning effort. That is part of the operations budget, but it's maintained separately. So we keep track of that. If not all of the money was spent in a particular year, it's rolled over into the next year in that same category. So onto the budget. Our 2021 total adopted was almost 700,000. The target for 2022 is 662. The recommended budget includes $180,000 additional. And we'll go through those, the three target requests that, over target requests that are in the budget includes some target funding, $60,000 for our operations budget, and then use of one-time funds, ARPA money, an agriculture horticulture meeting room education center, which will be a standalone structure. We'll talk about that in a second, and then the food system plan itself. The Food Policy Council requested, and it's incorporated into the recommended budget, $20,000 for implementation of the plan. And I'll go through these pretty quickly next. So these are the three target. The first one is on page 5-8. So back in 2020, as you all know, we, all of the agencies and the departments had cuts in the third and fourth quarters. Ours was the $94,000. We were able to pay for that through PPP in 2020. In 2021, we were level funded, and so that $90,000 is still showing up in our operations expenses. We basically used reserves, and we kept we froze hires and we froze pay. We didn't lay anybody off, but we froze any new hires. In 2022, and this is where we're asking for, and it's in the budget, $60,000 OTR to help meet that $90,000. Difference from the 2020 target. And so actually to Martha, to your point earlier about, tourism, yeah, the same trend in our case. We, you know, normally the county's been great in providing 2% adjustments, usually most years, that, you know, we're still actually with the $60,000 OTR. It's fantastic. We're getting it. And thank you very much for incorporating into the recommended budget. But it's still about 30,000 less than what we would be at 2020. So, the AgHort Education Center, again on page 5-8, it's showing up as recommended. This is a standalone meeting and classroom. It'll be sited on the property. And it's something that we've actually, wanted for some time. We did have contingency funding at one point with the county. But we weren't able to put it up at that particular time. The good news about that is that now we're designing it for to be able to do hybrid teaching as well as in on-site teaching. It will be high performance in terms of energy efficiency. It'll, you know, super insulated, et cetera. It also has built-in flood resilience. It'll be above the floodplain for this area. And it also is sort of wash and wear. So when, you know, if it did get flooded, the appliances, the utility, the electric will be higher than it would normally be. And, the floor could simply be power washed and we'd be able to use it, you know, as soon as electricity was restored to the neighborhood. It's a low cost approach to addressing our space needs here. It'll cost, less than probably $60 to $70 a foot less, and then our maintenance costs will be less. So it's a good way for us to meet one of our major long-term needs, which has been to have some kind of teaching place for composting and gardening, our gardening classes, our hort classes. And it can also be used as meeting space throughout the year. And the funding for this is coming from ARPA and from the CC board has approved the remaining funds that might, if there are additional funds needed, they've set aside money for that.
And where would this physically be?
You know where the parking lot is. It would be just east of the parking lot. There's an arbor, there's a garden site that's off of Day Street. And so it's between Day Street. It's on the west side of, so it's east of the parking lot, west of the grape arbor that's there.
Okay. Thank you.
And this third OTR was, as I said, the food system plan implementation. And Don and the Food Policy Council was just there with the legislature providing information on this last week. And then tomorrow, I just want to remind people that there is a gathering tomorrow night to basically look to gather more input as they move forward with that plan. The fourth OTR that we had asked for, which was not in the recommended budget, in part because it's a new initiative. This is something that we have been actually spending a fair amount of time on, and it's been emerging. Both it emerged out of the COVID response, out of our strategic plan that we're finishing up. We expect to have complete by the end of this year. And there's been this childhood nutrition collaborative which we're a part, has this Healthiest Cities and Counties grant from Aetna. And that has also been involved. It's been the need that's come out of, that we're talking about here, or we'll be talking about in a minute, emerged from all of these different activities. What we're going to talk about in a second is basically something that's been demonstrated to be successful. Locally, some of the things that we're talking about, were done, or we did some work with this as we responded to food needs in the, during COVID. So there's a connection there. This is also, Very much a strategic complement to the county's community health worker program, to the health department's community health worker program. We'll talk about that a little bit. And as I said, this initiative has been evolving. It's been something we've been working on for the past year, and then with the Healthiest Cities and these partners listed here is something that's been, it's continuing to evolve into what we're proposing tonight. There are two staff who are on, I think they're here tonight. And so if we have questions at the end of this, they would be available, to answer some of those questions. And again, I wanted to just emphasize that this program planning phase has really been a pretty deep effort. And it involves these collaborators listed here. They've been involved in both in the planning of this. They'll be involved in the execution. And then they'll also be working with us to identify long-term funding for this project. So what's the need? The need is basically to connect people to resources that already exist. Which could also improve community health outcomes, but are not really being utilized by many of the population that we're talking about. And then it's the second piece of this is the second need is really is to find out from people themselves why they're not accessing or that they can't access these particular resources, and then actually to begin to systematically address those barriers. The solution that we're proposing is something that's been done across the U.S. It's in several different sites. It's been done with university towns or in university locations, and it's really drawn on students who come from disadvantaged populations. So there are folks who actually can often relate. They have their backgrounds in some cases are similar to the populations that they would be interacting with, and so the navigators would address low-income and marginalized population or patients' immediate needs by initiating and tracking referrals to relevant resources. Where we have individuals with complex care needs. They would be connecting, the students would actually connect them with the community health workers who would be much more qualified, much better trained to actually deal with the comprehensive support that is needed by those individuals with complex care needs. So the students themselves would not be engaging in that kind of work. The short-term goal is to provide this immediate assistance by connecting people with those resources that actually already exist that would support their health and well-being. The immediate intermediate is, as we said, to identify those barriers and then to begin to inform policy and funding allocation decisions by once those barriers have been identified. And long-term, it's to use that data and this information about barriers to leverage public and private funding opportunities for community for coordinated care systems. The overall benefits that have been shown, and again, that the document that we shared with you last evening has more detail on this, and the students themselves, that staff who are here can share more information and can respond to questions if you have them. But the benefits are these here, the health, better health outcomes for folks who take advantage of these services that aren't currently taking advantage of them. There's potential cost savings for the county, but that's been shown elsewhere. And so we anticipate being able to save the county money, but the other two benefits are this being able to address barriers. And also to begin to be better, more data driven in terms of figuring out where spending on social determinants of health can have a maximum impact. So the OTR, which was submitted was seeking $50,000 a year for 3 years using one-time funding. So that in the funding, we'd go for staff time, for the training and support of students, for the support of community-based organizations and health sites to facilitate partnering with this so that they to basically enhance their own ability to respond. Programming, and then to carry out a program evaluation, which would really focus on demonstrating, evaluating and assessing whether connections to resources and the community health worker program are taking place, to identify those barriers, determine what the change, to determine whether patients their satisfaction does improve as a result of the initiative, and then also to quantify the value of this program for community members and for providers and the students themselves. And that is it for, so I'm going to stop sharing.
Thank you, Ken. Do I have questions for Ken? Mike Lane.
Ken, the last program you talked about for the medical referral, et cetera, how does that connect or doesn't it with our 211 program?
So, great question. And it was one that I have asked also, when this was first brought to my attention. So, Chris Kai Jones, I don't know if Chris is on. Okay. He's been talking with John Mazzello about this. And so I don't know if Chris, if you want to weigh in on that.
Yeah, I'll just answer quickly. Thank you, Ken, and thank you for the question. Yeah, we've been talking with John, basically, we see our program as aligning and complementing with 211. We plan to work with them going forward. What specifically we do, though, is because the students will be sited in healthcare sites, there's a very different kind of intentionality about two things. One, assessing what the needs are. So people fill out a sort of basically what's called a social determinants of health screening. So they identify areas where they have concerns and anxiety. And then those needs are specifically addressed by the navigator. They may refer to some of the work that 211 does, and that would be, you know, likely because it's a great program. But it's a very different intentionality from the outset. And then also the way in which we collect qualitative data and the way in which that can help us determine better resource allocation further on and understand better those barriers is going to be approached in a different way. But again, it will be done in alignment with 211 as part of a sort of coalition of different entities and stakeholders in the community who are currently working towards this basic goal, how to integrate the community with healthcare provision.
Thanks.
Okay. Now I have Martha and then Leslyn.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken and Chris. I'm just a little unclear how students are going to get personal information from patients. What, in a clinic, in a doctor's office? I don't understand, actually.
I'm happy to take that. Grace, I don't know if you wanted to.
Sure.
Grace is taking the lead. No,
sure. I'm Grace Parker-Zelinski. I'm the coordinator for the Childhood Nutrition Collaborative. So the social determinants of health screening tool that Chris just mentioned is really the only information that students will have. So patients will opt in to answering a few basic questions that are designed to identify social needs, and we're using a screening tool that's already been developed and piloted through CUGA Health Partners. And so the students have no access to electronic medical records. They will just be responding to information that people have disclosed directly to them and then consulting with those patients to determine which resources might meet their needs based on what's been identified by that screening.
So this is a CUGA Health Partners screening tool. So you'd be working with CUGA Health Partners?
Yes, CUGA Health Partners has been one of our foundational partners in the development of this program, and they will also be absolutely a strong partner in the implementation.
And how long do you expect students to do this? You know, one semester or... you know, the whole 3 years, or what's the, try to paint that picture for me.
Sure. Our initial partnership is with an existing program to expand what they do, and they have students who they ask for a one-year commitment, and then they often have students who will stay beyond that point. Their current student base is about 60 to 80 students per year doing different functions than this, and our pilot would only be starting with a smaller number than that. But based on their experience, we're expecting that we'd have students who would stay for a minimum of a year and likely longer than that.
So now you raise another question. So they've already got a program. Why do you need this?
Sure. So that program is called the Person-Centered Advocacy Team Program, and they are they're not making resource connections directly. That program is really just to provide a little bit of social support within healthcare settings. So they might sit with patients who are receiving chemotherapy prior to COVID, or you know, sit with ER patients and maybe get them a glass of water, that sort of thing. So they're students who have experience in healthcare settings, but this is really an expansion significantly of what they currently do. There's no mechanism for them to make resource connections currently.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Leslin and then Annie.
Thank you, Deborah. I think Martha asked most of my questions, but I probably still have a ton more questions than we have time for, since this is new. I think it warrants a lot more conversation and understanding around this. But one of the first questions out for me, aside from everything Martha asked and Mike as well about 211, is was there some sort of feasibility study, something that said that we needed this in this community that made you decide this is a program we should do? I mean, how did you come about making that decision?
Sure. I can start there. And then if you have anything to add, please do. So one of the things that led us to this program is recognizing that we have many, many resources in this community that are really underutilized by the populations that are eligible for them. So just as some straightforward examples, we have data around SNAP and WIC that show that only about half of our eligible populations are currently using those programs, and actually less for WIC. And that is true of many other programs as well. And we know that there are significant health outcomes that are associated with those programs, as well as costs associated with the social risks that occur when people are not using those programs. So we've laid out in some supporting documentation some of that data specific to Tompkins and more generally based on other communities. So we do have some information about that in the supporting documentation as well.
I appreciate that, but I'm still at a place where I think we need a much larger discussion in understanding this and understanding what's the potential impact for Tompkins County. I want to go back to something you talked about a little earlier, and that's about the farmers and PPE, and I missed what you said about helping or supporting the farmers in getting the PPEs, and they all Tompkins County farmers. I wasn't understanding what you said.
So there were actually, I'm glad you mentioned the PPE. I had mentioned
the PPP rather.
Okay. But in fact, we did actually work with both, as a matter of fact. But when farmers, you know, farmers became eligible for, PPP, there were several different loan programs that were available to farmers. One of which was PPP, and then there were two others, the names of which I'm forgetting right now. County Ag staff, so the staff here in our association, as well as the staff who are on the regional dairy and field crops team, of which we're a member, those staff worked with about 280 farmers, 281 or 282 farmers, to help them get the PPP loans.
Okay.
Thank you,
Leslyn. All right, Annie and then Amanda.
Thanks, Deborah, and thanks for the presentation, Ken. I had a follow-up question with Grace and Chris, maybe two questions. First off, thanks for sending me the information about this program. Was this sent to other legislators also, do you know?
Yeah, the six-page document on the program that we were just, yes, that was sent to all.
That was sent to everybody? Okay. And I'm following up what some other legislators were asking about the program. Would this, how do you find people for this program?
Do you mean, just a clarifying question, do you mean in terms of patients who would be utilizing it or the navigators themselves?
The people who would be utilizing them. Do you go to doctor's offices, ERs, community organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. So we would be partnering with healthcare providers. So we've already been talking to some providers, and then they would be adding the screening tool directly into their intake paperwork for anyone who opted to complete it. And then they would have the option of having a navigator follow up with them from there.
Okay. So I see this is modeled by, from some programs that are already happening in other municipalities. Just what thinking about people, and this talks about equity for services, and maybe this is just not part of your program, but just thinking about people who aren't connected, you know, to healthcare services yet.
Yeah, I think that once we have some information from a pilot around this of how this is how this functions in different sites, I think that there is great potential to be able to scale to other kinds of community sites that might be working with folks who are not currently involved in healthcare. One of the reasons that we are starting where we are is we're starting with the OBGYN practice because they are currently our only practice serving, that is offering perinatal services. And so everybody who is accessing those services is going through that practice currently.
Thanks, Grace. And I just add as well that the student navigators would also be working with the different practices in their outreach. So for example, we're in conversations with CHP about how the residents are going to be working in mobile home parks and other kinds of outreach where we would be playing sort of supportive roles in doing that.
Okay, thank you. Because I just know that some people wind up using as their primary practitioners to go to the ER or some other emergency service like that. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Annie. Amanda?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Ken, for the presentation. And I just wanted to add that Chris and Grace reached out to both Shauna and I, and we had some good conversations about this, and they kind of walked us through it and explained, a bit more about it, that they have been developing it with Sam Hilson at the health department. It's not just sort of happening in a vacuum. There are other folks that they've been working with on this for a while, and it is still evolving, which is why the blurb in our budget book is very different than the information that they sent out. So if you haven't had a chance to read that information that was sent, please do. And Shauna and I are putting in an amendment to the budget to include this. So that's all. Thank you.
Yeah, and if I could just add that, I did say it, but it may have been glossed over, but there was a slide in there that really, that talked about the partners that do exist. So there's a substantial amount of partnering that's actually already been going on. The Cougar Health Partnership is what part of it, but so are a number of other groups and groups that aren't necessarily listed there as partners. So for example, the 211 and John are people who've been involved in this process. And so there is a pretty wide group of people who've actually been engaged in the thinking around this and the planning for this.
Okay, Martha.
Yeah, just so are there other communities that have done this?
Yes.
Yes. We're drawing on models from other communities and really adapting pieces of what they're doing with our partners to figure out what will work the best in our Tompkins County context.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, if that's all, we will move on to soil and water. And thanks to Ken and
thank
Chris.
You all.
And I'm sorry. What is
Grace?
Grace.
Yeah.
Thank you
all for your good work.
Thank you so much.
All right. John Negley, Soil and Water, and you can find that on page 5-29 of your books. Hi, John.
Hello, everybody. Are you able to see my screen there?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Well, thank you all for the opportunity, and I will have a fairly simple presentation tonight because we are not asking for any OTRs. We are remaining level from our 2021 appropriation. But I did want to kind of give a brief overview of some of the trends of the district over time and where our budget has been and where we are heading. And how 2020 and 2021 has kind of impacted some of our budget. So this is a little bit hard to read, but you kind of get the idea. Three bars there. The blue one is appropriations that we have received since 2001. You can kind of see that trend going up. So that's great. And we thank you for that support to the district. The middle green bar is appropriations that have been approved by you all within the budget. And then the red bar is what has been requested at these meetings, the budget meetings, by the district. So 2020, you can see, you know, pre-pandemic, that was, it was an interesting year for us. We requested over $400,000 for our appropriation, and that was the highest we've ever requested from the county. That included our engineer OTR and additional staff person, and we were granted the additional engineer target appropriation. But then pandemic hit as we were interviewing for engineers and going through the process, and then we received funding cuts the third and fourth quarter of 2020. So that's where you see the blue bar bringing our appropriation down to where it has been level for 2021 and 2022 going forward. So it would be great to get back to this green bar here at some point as a target request so that we could fully support that engineer position. Kind of looking at our operational fund balance over the course of the last few years, the left-hand side is income, and this is just our operational fund balance. Similar to what we just heard from CCE, we have operational budget and then also program and grant budgets that we run off of. Usually those programs and grants pull in about $2 to $3 million every year to various entities, whether it's farmers or municipalities or landowners that we work with. So in 2020, you can see that green bar of income. That is New York State Part C funding, state aid that we get through the Environmental Protection Fund.
Yes.
That can be utilized in a variety of different ways by the district. So some of it goes towards our operational costs. Some of it goes to programmatic costs based upon the needs in the the county and how the board decides to utilize those funds. So as you can see, we are operating okay through 2020 and 2021 and 2022, as long as the Environmental Protection Fund and our state aid remains intact, which it seems to be so far. Looking at another trend, just from our net position and fund balance, you can see 2010, 2011, 2012, some rough years for the district. We've climbed out of that hole, and we are now in a good net position. You know, obviously 2020 saw a little bit of reductions there with county appropriations and state aid, but hopefully that will trend back the other way over time. And I show this every year just to kind of show where our appropriations are in relation to other soil and water districts that are adjacent to us. So we're at a pretty good rate, excluding one larger district, mostly agricultural district, that receives a pretty good portion of their budget from the county. So again, I'm very appreciative of the appropriations that we get to this district. And, you know, just a cost benefit for every dollar that is invested into the district in 2020, we were able to pull back $2 into the county through grants, programs that are either from federal sources, state sources, and that equaled about $651,000 of state and federal revenues. And then just some 2020 accomplishments. You know, a lot of our work is soil and water. Obviously, it's in our name. But we do a lot of planning, working with county planning departments, agencies, watershed agencies, the Cuba Lake Watershed Network, the Intermunicipal Organization, and touch a lot of different planning activities, whether it's on the ground, where we're doing land use planning with farmers or local residences, you know, 66 technical site assistance visits in a pandemic year. That was a bit challenging to coordinate all those and be on people's property, but we were able to do that. Watershed management planning, working a lot with the Cuyahoga Lake TMDL, and commenting on that process. And I know the legislature and the Water Resources Council also commented on that this past year. Something to kind of keep in the forefront of our mind is it's going to affect Cuyahoga Lake and how we interact with that. Also, Owasco Lake, the nine-element plan that's happening there. It's not on this slide, but also the Upper Susquehanna Coalition we work with quite regularly, and the TMDL that's on that watershed. Also working with the Tompkins County Stormwater Coalition, Angel Heinekel in our office is pretty much the manager of that program, and works with the 10 municipalities through our municipal separate storm sewer system, the MS4 regions, making sure they are in compliance with stormwater regulations, and also looking at violations with municipal towns, and helping the code enforcement officers implement their stormwater laws. Also, just implementation projects. We had two large stream stabilization projects in 2020. And I will say 2021 saw that greatly increase with the amount of rain that we've had this past summer. It's been extremely wet. I pray we do not get any more rain. There's been a lot of flooding, a lot of erosion issues out there. And I think that's something we'll have to kind of think about going forward with, grants are a great way to implement these projects. But, A lot of these are private landowners, smaller landowners that may not have the match requirements for these grants to implement. So that might be something to kind of consider going forward. Also run our hydroseeding program with local towns and municipalities. We had 98,000 feet of road ditch stabilized with hydroseeding. Also worked a lot with putting in some riparian buffers with the Upper Susquehanna Coalition and wetland construction projects. So pretty neat projects. Also invasive species management. A hydrilla is still an ongoing issue within the south end of Cuga Lake. Unfortunately, we're starting to see some other invaders with spotted lantern fly that's come in, going to be affecting crops. Something that the Finger Lakes Prism has been monitoring very closely, and I know there's going to be a webinar in October. If anybody's interested, I can send you information on that. But just invasive species is a burgeoning issue that we're just going to have to start dealing with and managing more closely. And then obviously our ag environmental management program, pretty robust funding from the state, work with the assessment department, did 132 soil group worksheets this past year on 6,531 acres. That really helps out the farms in the area with tax reductions. Also installing a lot of cover crops. It's been a highlight of our program the past few years, knowing the benefits of cover crops on farms. And then obviously manure management and trying to keep that from entering into our waterways with storage and transfer systems so that they can store it at a time when it's high risk of runoff and apply it when the plants need it. So, like I said, it's a pretty simple presentation, but hopefully there's some questions and I can answer them.
Okay, John, do you want to stop sharing your screen,
yep.
Please?
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Mike Lane.
Hi, John.
Hi, Mike.
Your report. Thank you. Is your department still involved with the Village of Dryden flood control study for Egypt Creek?
We are, yeah. I've been in conversation with the mayor and USGS and trying to figure out where USGS is with their flood study. I know that they've completed a flood mapping scenario for the Village of Dryden. That needs a little bit more gauging. So, like, there's a gauging station out on Six Mile Creek. We have some gauging stations on Cuga Inlet, Salmon Creek. Those stations are they're expensive to maintain on a yearly basis. They're about $30,000 to $40,000 per year to maintain, and then probably another $30,000 to $60,000 to install. That's a recurring cost to the village that would have to be borne.
Particularly concerned is that upstream on Egypt Creek is TC3.
Yep.
And they're having trouble with respect to their retention pond and the overflow and an erosion issue up there. Underground springs under the parking lots and things like that. Have they been in touch with you at all yet about that? And
TC3 has not been, We have been up there with the flood study with the village. So I can
talk with TC3 and they may be in touch with you about that. But that's an issue. Of course, the county is the joint owner of TC3 with Cortland County.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Martha.
Thanks, Deborah. Thank you, John. I'm a little confused about the engineer. So it sounds like you got the funding for the engineer and were in the hiring process when COVID hit. You did, am I right? You did not hire that person yet?
We did not, no. So as we were in the hiring process, COVID hit, we had one application, and one applicant that we were pursuing, offered the position to that person. And basically that was March, end of March. And they were coming up from New York City and did not want to, lose the position they were in. And there was just a lot of issues with that. And so that pretty much put us on hold for hiring. And then we've also been in conversations with, human resources and just salary ranges with some of that and, making that equitable across the entire county.
So do I understand, does your budget still include funding for that position?
So it does, but it's not totally from the county anymore. We would have to supplement that with the state aid Part C funding that we get to fully fund that engineer. So right now we are going out to private contractors to fulfill the engineering needs.
Okay, so what I understand, what I remember from, was it 2 years ago or three, that you felt you could be much more cost effective by having somebody in-house.
Mm-hmm.
So now what I'm hearing is you have some of the money in county allocation that pays for this function, but not enough to hire somebody in-house.
Yeah, if we were to totally utilize just county funding, we wouldn't have enough to pay for that person. We would have to utilize our state aid funding. And in 2019 and 2020, that was the first years that we received that Part C state aid. And we were unsure of how stable that funding was from the state. And with 2020, we were very unsure with how stable the state budget was. So we didn't want to hire somebody and then have to lay them off 6 months down the road because we didn't have a budget line item for them. So I think now that there's some more stability, probably in 2022, we will reopen that position and try to hire that full time with what we have from the county and supplement with state aid.
Okay, so you feel with patching those two pieces together, you have what you need to hire that person.
Yeah, yeah.
Great, okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Yeah, Martha, the whole process of trying to hire that engineer could be the basis for a soap opera. And I'm pretty sure you don't want to hear that. But anyhow, I do have a question, John, and I don't mean to come out of left field at you, but can you explain to me why the Soil and Water District needs to have fund balance and what it could be used for?
So a lot of times what we have the ability to utilize state aid, so Part C, we can utilize how we need to. A lot of times that's with programmatic efforts. Having a fund balance and having that reserve, I'm assuming you're talking about having some type of reserve account.
Right.
Yeah. I think we've talked about that in the past of having that ability if 2020 happened, again, it's nice to have those reserves so that we're not in a 2010, 2011 situation where, we are in a negative position. And also we do have a lot of grants that we cash flow. It is nice to be able to have, and we've worked with the county on that $200,000 cash flow account. So it's, you know, we try to separate out operational expenses from that cash flow account that we work with, the programmatic expenses. So operationally, I think that's more of just a rainy day. And I don't feel like we need a ton in that account, but it's still something that we should have as a rainy day fund.
And I know we've used that in the past, for example, to fund projects for local people who are too small an operation to qualify for state grants. That's another useful thing we can use it for.
Yep.
Okay, Annie?
Thanks, Deborah. Thanks, John. I think I remember, as Martha said, you talked about some of these things, the engineer and wanting this fund, last year, the year before or so. I can't remember exactly when, but I think when you talked about the fund before, it was partly to kind of float, help you guys float as you're waiting for reimbursement, especially when it comes to the year end. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's that $200,000 loan that we mm-hmm. we ask for pretty much on a yearly basis, as separate from the budget. It's a separate contract. And I think this year we've been able to work out with Rick being able to, you'll probably see that fairly soon on the agenda, come through the PEAT committee and then to the full legislature for that contract. And then, I think we would only be out of that $200,000 loan advance for maybe a week or two at the beginning of the year, so that we always kind of have that account there. And basically how we use that is, as a, say a farmer has a project and it's a $300,000 project or a $200,000 project, or let's use a simple one, let's do a $100,000 project. We can pay that bill, and then we're the ones waiting for that reimbursement from the state rather than the farmer or the contractor themselves that are trying to cash flow projects and usually don't have that amount of money on hand. So.
Okay, well, thank you. And since you're bringing it to PEAK, we can talk more about it then if I or other people have questions. But I'm glad. I know you said a few years ago you needed to have that, so I'm glad there's that Rick and administration was able to help you set that up. Thank you.
Thanks, Annie. As we move forward, thank you, John, for coming in, and thank you for reviewing all the things that the Soil and Water District has worked on. I think it's well worth it to remember that a lot of the problems that are facing us in terms of our water quality and our watershed and the health of our lakes are very much dependent on the work that Soil and Water does, and they do it very well. So thank you.
Thank you all.
Okay. Have a nice evening.
You too.
And I bet now we can welcome our entire Veterans Affairs staff to our meeting.
Come on, y'all. Come on.
and you're on. Yeah, and you're on page, let's see, 4-216.
Yes. And I'd like to say hello to everybody while you're looking me up there. It's always good to see you this time of year. Plus,
welcome,
I get to
Jay.
Say a belated, thank you. Get to say a happy belated birthday to my department. We turned 2 years old in August. So I think that's pretty cool to be able to say.
Congratulations.
Thank you. JR.
I don't feel a day over a toddler.
Now you know how to do everything.
Oh, if only. I'm in the middle of a training right now with the state, and they're showing us all how much we do and don't know. And it's definitely an eye-opener for me. But I definitely appreciate the opportunity. So, and if you would like, I'll go ahead and start my share screen.
Please do.
All right. All right. Do you see me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good news. All right. Well, I will just jump over to, well, I like my first screen. I just wanted to show that because it's got all the Army military branches there. And, of course, Navy smack in the middle. I really like that was there because that's my old stomping ground. But so today I'm presenting my budget. And our recommended budget, as you see here, I am seeking a modest increase in my budget for the starving expansion of my department. And I'll explain more of that as we go along, but just to show you that snapshot of what we're talking about. Full-time equivalent, as was noted, I am it. And I've been, for the first 2 years of the department, it has been myself. This year, I'm looking to try and expand that, at least start with a person, part-time position. And this position is being funded through a combination of target funding, plus rollover, plus support from the county administration. My over-target request, I'll start with the second one first, and that is a vehicle. I'm looking for a department vehicle just because it helps to get around. Right now, I am sharing with the COFA, the Office for the Aging, and that has worked great except for times when we've both needed to be places at the same time. And depending on what it is, there are times when I'll definitely defer to the services that COFA is offering because I feel that those are important. But they also know that if I have something that's important, they'll also defer to me. So it's been a good cooperation here. But I would like to pull us out of that and or at least minimize that as much as possible by having a vehicle that I have better access to. And that vehicle will allow me to go to outreach events. Particularly one of the things I'd like to do is get on track with scheduling kind of like office hours at the various veteran services posts around the county. Also, there are other things that require my presence, and it would be good to do without running into a time conflict with COFA staff as they try to do the various things that they need to do for transportation. And the this money, this request, OTR, is being seated with rollover from my department. For my top priority, as I said, is for a part-time position. This would be an information aide. And this position is also being funded through a combination of target and one-time funding through ARPA funds. This support person will be here to basically be here with me, but in addition, at the times when I'm not here. Often there are times when either I'm in a training or I am out of town. Sometimes I do actually get to take off. But I may have a training. I may have to be somewhere else out on an appointment or something else. And it would be good to really have a live person for a visitor, a caller, a veteran to be able to interact with. And I think having a second person here to help with some of the support things that I've learned that I need, administrative as well as I'd like to have them involved with outreach and definitely beef up my social media presence. And there's a short list of things that they have, but that's just to give you an introduction of what some of the things that this person would do. Also, this person is going to be, this position, I should say, will be what I hope is the start of a slow expansion of my office, because what I'd like for this position to be is a veteran so that they can be, I can position them for promotable roles. And that would be to be either a veteran services assistant or a veteran services officer in the future. And are there any questions? I do want to say thank you on behalf of the opportunity to be able to serve our community of veterans in Tompkins County. And I open the floor to questions.
Okay, thanks, JR. If you want to stop sharing your screen. And then I'll be able to see if there are questions. Are there questions? Mike Lane.
The picture you just showed, JR, was of the annual veterans bonfire. I understood it happened, but I didn't hear any publicity about it, so I didn't know it was going to go this year.
All right. We wondered, me and Frank wondered where you were because we always see you there. You're a regular fixture. Actually, my daughter even knows where you usually stand. So we did miss you there this year.
Well, I would like to have been there. But the other question I had is,
Do we still have a state veterans officer in the area?
We do. Actually, we had just moved that person, that position down to our building, which was really cool. But coming out of COVID, or going into COVID, of course, that stopped all visits. The state officer closed. We had just opened things back up, and he started visiting here. And then the state reduced his times from being a weekly visit to twice monthly. And right now that is that is going away, so I'm trying to work with to see what we can do to get that back.
So they would be holding office hours at your office? Is that the idea?
Correct. That is. Okay. He actually has had a few visits here. We have him set up in the large conference room. Thanks to facilities, they set up a very nice office area for him. And he was able to have his own run. He has his own schedule. So, but we would basically be his ground of operation.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks. Martha?
Thank you, Deborah. Hey, JR. Thanks for the presentation.
Thank you, Martha.
Where would this support person sit?
Right now, we have a place identified in the Kofitz toward the back of the building. I don't know if you're familiar. The whole building has been flipped around through COVID, so when people come in, they see a new building within this new building. And so there's a workstation towards the back half of this front part of the building where that person would be situated. That's the initial place. Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, I haven't been there in, 18 months at least, so okay. And good to hear that you would share this car with COFA. How many cars do they have?
One. They have one.
Their whole department has one?
Whole department has one, and they shared it with me.
That was nice of them. So, okay.
Thank you very much. Yes, I definitely appreciated it. But I've also, because of that, I've also learned where other places that I've tried to borrow a car from and within the county's fleet. And I've been happy to do that, and I've been thankful for the support of the other departments, but also I've run into times when they've had to say no as well.
Okay. Sounds like a good investment. Thanks, JR.
Thank you.
Thank you, Henry.
Yes, JR, thank you for the presentation. What do you do now when you're not in the office with calls or people dropping by?
Voicemails, my friend. That's my best secretary. Beyond that is email, and I have, with the help of Alana at the county clerk's office, set up a basically it's a questionnaire that we have that's available on our computer here in the building, as well as a hard copy. If someone wants to come in, they can basically request an appointment by filling out that, and then I can get back to them.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
Anything else for JR? Well, thank you, JR. Thank you for the enthusiasm and heart that you've brought to this new office. And I hope you find someone who can bring the same level of commitment to this halftime position. And
thank
happy
you.
Birthday to the Department of Veteran Services, or the Veteran Services Agency. I can't remember what you're called anymore.
All the above. the
All
department
right.
thanks you. My staff thanks you.
Great.
Yes,
thanks.
Department of Veteran Services, Veteran Service Agency, whichever you'd like.
Okay. JR's office is what I think of it. But anyway. Okay. So we'll be moving on now to social services, and that is on page 4-196 of your book. And I see Kit's here. Hi, Kit.
Hi. How are you, Deborah?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
So we're looking forward to seeing your screen.
Okay. Well, let's see if I can make that happen. Let's see here. Okay, and we just need to.
Oh, wait, it's 4-196. Yeah, all right.
All right, can everybody see that? Is that coming out correctly?
Yes, ma'am. You might want to put it in presentation mode because it's still got the little slides on the side.
Okay, sorry about that. Let's see if I can make that happen. Well, I thought I had this all set up.
We can struggle through with the way it is. Wait, there goes something.
Is that correct?
It's a blank screen.
Okay. Geez, I'm really sorry. How about now? Okay.
That's good.
All right. Perfect. So thank you. Thank you for having us tonight. I'm obviously here to present the proposed 2022 budget for the Tompkins County Department of Social Services. I'm Kit Kephart, Commissioner at DSS. And in the interim county administrator's recommended budget, the pages that correspond to our budget are section 4, pages 196 to 205. You might have already said that, Deborah. Sorry if I'm
repeating
that.
We're slow learners.
In putting together this year's budget, there were many challenges and considerations to take into account. One of the greater challenges that it seems the Department of Social Services always faces is what we know that we don't yet know as we develop our budget for next year. And historically, we've referred to these as our known and unknowns. So we're going to talk a little bit about those. Social services faces significant uncertainty from year to year in how legislative and program changes may affect our budget. Our known unknown slide is a brief review of the areas that may have the most significant impacts. While our known and unknowns are not reflected in our budget request for next year, they are important to be aware of as they have the potential to really impact our fiscal reality for next year. Currently, our Family First Prevention Services Act will, the Family First Prevention Services Act will go into effect tomorrow. The federal legislation was supposed to go into effect 2 years ago, but New York State received a waiver to delay its implementation until this fall. So while we've been working for the past 2 years to prepare for the Family First to commence, there are still many unknowns about how this implementation may reduce federal 4E funding and reimbursement for congregate and other foster care placements for children. We also don't know if federal reimbursement is reduced, how much, if any, the state may increase funding in our foster care block grant. Another unknown, as you're aware, New York State has extended the eviction moratorium, and currently there's considerable pandemic-related rental assistance funding available, like the ERAP, the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, or ESG, the Emergency Solutions Grant funding. And until recently, other pandemic supplemental benefits were also available. A current unknown is what the demand for emergency housing and other services will look like when the moratorium ends and life continues to kind of return to a new normal. Currently, we suspect anecdotally that there will be families that will reach out in need, but we really can't be sure what the extent of the need will be or what factors may influence this as we get further down the road. Our next known unknown concerns COPS funding. For the past few years, we continue to wonder if the Community Options Preventive Services or COPS funding will be continued, and if not, what will replace it? The reason for the uncertainty is because the governor's budget for last year proposed to completely eliminate COPS funding and replace it with something else that wasn't outlined. However, we were pleasantly surprised that this year our county's COPS funding was significantly increased, and I'll talk more about that good news for this year related to COPS funding shortly. However, in general, we just can't really predict right now how COPS funding will be impacted in the future. And lastly, a big unknown is if the state will continue to maintain its current Medicaid financing structure. As everyone is aware, what happens with Medicaid will significantly impact us at the county level. And unfortunately, this is an area that it's been difficult to gain solid information about, and therefore impossible to know what the impact might look like. And I'm going to speak a little bit more about that shortly as well. So on our next slide, we look at our recommended budget figures compared with this year's adopted and modified budgets. I'm going to take a minute to talk about a couple of points of interest. So as you can see, both of our total expenditures and total revenues are much lower for next year compared to the 2021 adopted budget. And the single greatest reduction in expenditures and revenues that we see in our recommended budget figures are due to the state's early termination of the Raise the Age Gap funding. You may remember us having talked about being in Anchor County last year. This was a designation that provided a way for us to pass through state funds to contracted partners that were serving youth related to the Raise the Age legislation. And this arrangement was supposed to extend through June of 2022. However, the state concluded it at the end of March of this year. So with that termination of funding, our Anchor County role also ended about 15 months sooner than we anticipated. And this has resulted in a large but local cost neutral change in our budget. So about $8.9 million that was a part of the 2021 adopted budget is absent from the 2022 recommended budget due to this change. So moving on from local cost neutral changes in our budget, I want to talk about the year-to-year difference that are impacting our local cost. The difference between the local cost of our OTRs and our total local cost is about $555,000. $555,000. This represents the increased local cost for our mandate programs. 25% of this total is the result of fluctuations in expenditures and revenues across various budgetary programs, but the overwhelming majority of this, about 75% of it, is due to Medicaid. So when it comes to Medicaid, there always seems to be some bad news, and this year is no exception. However, there's also some good news. This past spring, New York State Department of Health released projections that showed a reduction in our expected federal reimbursement for Medicaid under both the Affordable Cares Act and the CARES Act. Our budget reflects that. However, we do anticipate that our actual required contributions will be lower due to the extended coverage of the CARES Act-derived EFMAP. And as you probably are aware, EFMAP is the federal medical assistance percentage that the federal government pays for the Medicaid program. So moving on from Medicaid, I mentioned earlier that there was some good news related to community options for preventive services or COPS funding. This funding has been uncertain over the past few years, but our share of COPS funding for this year has increased to support the maximum of 63.7% reimbursement rate. And in recent years, our reimbursement rate has been closer to around 40%. So that's some good news. The final category impacting our 2022 budget request are our over-target requests. But before I get into those, I wanted to give you a brief overview of social services staffing. So the 2022 recommended budget for DSS shows an increase of 1.5 times full-time equivalents. This brings our total to 181 FTEs, which is still about half an FTE less than we had in 2020. And this chart shows us the positions and what divisions within the department are anticipated to experience changes in staffing. In the Economic Assistance Division, on the left-hand side of this chart, most of the changes that you see here are due to retirements. In the Accounting Division, the changes that show here represent promotions of existing staff. In Administration, the four positions that are asterisked are each among our over-target requests, so I'll talk more about them shortly. And in Children's Services like Accounting, although there have been changes in particular titles, the net change to our FTEs is zero. Finally, the increased security officer positions are related to better need to better manage coverage and a couple of long-term medical leaves. So the next two slides list our OTRs in order of priority. The description of the positions and the line items in the budget book in section four are on pages 200 and 1,000 tonight. Our interim county administrator, Lisa Holmes, has recommended funding for all of our over-target requests for 2022, and we're grateful for that. The first over-target request is to hire a director of administrative services trainee. Social Services' current Director of Administrative Services has served in his role for about 25 years and plans to retire in about 18 months. This is really a crucial position at Social Services that combines budget management, state and federal claiming, the understanding of social policy, and the budgetary impacts on all of our programs. We anticipate that it will take a minimum of about 18 months for a trainee to learn the basics of this position and then to begin to really act independently in this role. So we're asking for one-time funding because once this person transitions fully to the Director of Administrative Services role, we'll no longer need that trainee position. Our second OTR is target funding to support the addition of a third social services attorney in our legal team that serves primarily our Children's Services Division at DSS. There are a number of changes primarily related to new legislation that have happened in the recent past or are anticipated to begin soon that are significantly increasing the workload of our attorneys in social services. In January of 2020, New York State PINS or persons in need of supervision reform went into effect. As I mentioned earlier, the anticipated start of the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act, which goes into effect tomorrow, will increase our legal workload. And then the addition locally of a third family court judge, and finally the state central registry reform legislation, which will also go into effect January of 2022, are all influencing our need to add to our legal team. Our third OTR refers to the one-time community option preventive services funding that I have mentioned before, and that covers four prevention contracts. The programs related to this OTR are the Child Development Council's Expanded Family Support Services, the Advocacy Center's Preventive Youth Services, Cooperative Extension's Parenting Education Classes, and Tompkins Community Action's Primary School Family Support. Participation in these programs is 100% voluntary, and they're open to anyone in our community. The intent behind providing COPS programs is that in providing supports to families early and voluntarily, it will lessen the necessity for greater intervention on a mandatory basis later on by social services. So it should be noted that COPS funding also supports the probation department's provision of supervision services for youth. However, that contract is in our base budget. So the next and fourth over-target request is target funding for a human resources coordinator. The title of this will probably and likely change as social services and HR work through the details of establishing the anticipated position. But the position will function as an internal liaison between social services and the HR department to ensure compliance with civil service rules and county policy and procedures. The position will work with our department's about 10 division coordinators to oversee recruitment, hiring, promotion, and performance-related actions. There's a great need within social services for a centralized position that will manage and track many of the regulatory and required functions, such as employee licenses and certifications, background checks, fingerprinting, and then to handle time card processing. Moving on to our fifth over-target request, as I have mentioned previously, Family First goes into effect tomorrow, and that limits payment for congregate care for children. The intent of the Family First legislation is to discourage congregate care placements in favor of placements of family-type settings with a particular emphasis on kinship care. Our Children's Services Division has really had great success in minimizing the number of children in congregate care placements. However, it may be necessary at times for DSS or the courts to place a child in respite until a family-type placement can be made available. Sometimes it's necessary to have a child go into respite when tensions run high in a foster placement, and respite may have the effect of preserving a placement by giving families and children a periodic break. This will also be family-based respite. So this funding is actually to contract with a state-approved voluntary foster care agency who will then recruit and train families to provide specialized respite care in their homes. It is hoped that having this option available will avert more expensive placements and keep kids in our community. We requested one-time local funding, but Lisa has recommended ARPA funds, which would result in this being a no local cost OTR. So our next and sixth OTR is in response to a significant increase in audits being conducted by state program oversight agencies in recent years. Coordinating the extensive documentation that's requested with each audit, transmitting it then to the state, and then making program changes as a result is a huge responsibility. And without the position to manage this, all of this falls entirely on the staff that are also serving clients or managing direct service needs of the department. So this position will act as a liaison between department staff and the state, provide supervisory oversight for work divisions that respond to most of the child welfare audits, and then conduct regular internal audits to ensure compliance and preparedness for upcoming reviews. Our seventh over-target request reflects our plan to annually replace about one quarter of our vehicle fleet each year. And in years past, this has been in our base budget, but to satisfy the 12% reduction required in the 2021 budget process, it was approved last year on a one-time basis. So we're reflecting this as an OTR again this year. And finally, our last OTR, we have included staff appreciation and recognition events as an OTR this year. Social services is a large department and is spread out among four floors. And because of the many programs that operate, the staff do so within different programs. Special efforts need to really be made to create opportunities for staff to meet one another and connect. One way to do this, and some feedback that came through staff in the climate survey process, was that they really valued quarterly gatherings to provide these opportunities. We're requesting resources to enable us to provide recognition events for staff, as well as opportunities that would support connection within the department. So that is the end of our over-target requests. However, I want to speak briefly to what we didn't include in our OTRs this year. Someone might have anticipated that we would have included an over-target request for replacement computer equipment, but New York State supplied us with 181 new PCs this year, so therefore we don't need to replace any new equipment next year. Finally, we are not requesting local funds to supplement our Solutions to End Homelessness grant at this time. The legislature has graciously approved our past OTRs for supplemental funds to provide rental assistance through this program, but presently with ERAP and ESG programs that have emerged, they're providing state and federal monies that supply similar or the same support as the STEP program. So we currently don't know when the funding for these programs will be fully obligated. And as I mentioned earlier, we can't predict what level of need will be in our community when the eviction moratorium ends. So we may be asking you for funding support next year once these factors are known better, but currently we are not. And as I mentioned before, we're grateful that all of these OTRs were included in the recommended budget. So I'd like to open it for any questions. Thank you in advance for your time and consideration of all that we've put forth tonight.
Thank you, Kit. That was an excellent presentation. Could you please screen and so I can see who has questions? And while you're doing that, I don't know if this is a question for you or for Lisa, but I notice on several of the recommended OTRs, money comes out of DSS ADM, which reduces the impact on the local budget. So if somebody could just explain what that means, I would be very grateful.
So I'm trying to disengage here from the share screen. Oh, here, I just found it. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
So could you ask that question again, Deborah, just so that I can be sure I'm getting it?
Yeah. So there are several OTRs where they are in whole or in part offset by money coming out of 610 DSS admin, and I just wondered what that was. I could hazard a guess, but I'd really prefer to actually know.
Okay. Deborah, can you tell me, is this in the budget book on a specific page that you're referencing?
For example, on page, let me put my glasses on because I'm getting old. On page 205, you've got OTR number 84. You've got vehicles, 125,000. And then there are two minuses, 45,000 out of target, 42,005 out of target, and it supposedly comes out of this DSS ADM account.
Out of the administrative account. Okay, so Tom, could you speak to that? I'm not as familiar with how that balances.
I definitely can. Those two cryptically named revenue lines, Deborah, refer to federal reimbursement of our administrative expenditures and state reimbursement for those expenditures. The line that has the object code 44610 is federal reimbursement, and the line that has the object code 43610 is state reimbursement. You're welcome. That will be consistent for all of our over target requests.
Okay, that's great. So we don't have to pay for everything. That's terrific.
That's right. In fact, all of our over target requests, except the one for the respite bed, the local share is a fraction. I think on average, something between 25 and 30% of the total cost.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that, Tom.
And also, I'm sorry, just a footnote to that, if I may, and that's why ARPA funds are not applied to any of those one-time costs because they can't be used in combination with federal funding. The respite bed is the only exception to that in the OTRs for DSS, and that's why ARPA funds were applied there.
Right, because we're not able to claim any reimbursement on that. Yep.
Thanks. That's a good point for us to remember. Shauna, you have a question?
Yeah, I know that our staff has had some real concerns about their safety, the safety in the building as well as the safety in the parking lot. And I wanted to see if in conversations, if there has been a decision in regards to the plan moving forward, and if we would see an OTR for a safety plan for that building.
So I would say, Shauna, currently we do not have plans for that. However, I think that's probably largely because we're really in the midst of kind of talking about what that would look like. I know that Lisa and Amy have been working, and I don't want to speak for you, Lisa, but I know you guys are working on some things, and there has been conversation, and certainly we've been looking at the safety of our building. Currently, we don't have a structure plan to propose, but as that planning goes forward, we would bring that forward if it looks like there are changes that we need to make. Currently we would need to look at what is the plan for any sort of safety or security kinds of restructuring.
Okay. I was just wondering if there might be an idea to put some money in the contingent fund so that, for one, our employees know that we're very concerned about this and, we're willing to make changes in the near future. But also so that we account for those changes.
I'll speak to that also, Shauna. So thank you for bringing it up. And it is something that we're actively discussing with all of the departments in the building. And we have recently had, a walkthrough with the sheriff, and who's found the building itself, to be relatively safe And that many of the procedures that have been put into place, you know, there are certainly improvements that can be made, but probably not wholesale improvements. A lot of the safety concerns are the pathways to and from the building, from the parking lots in the neighborhood, which are a little harder and more insidious to be able to address with one fell swoop, one solution. So, you know, we're working across multiple areas, and we'll certainly be keeping the legislature informed, our employees informed on how to move forward. And if we find areas where we feel we can improve the security for our employees, we want to do that, and we'll be letting you know what that costs and bringing forward a proposal and recommendation. So thank you.
Great, thank you. And my second question is in regards to Code Blue and asking if the state is still going to contribute the same amount they have in past years.
Currently, yes, as far as we know. We haven't received any changes to that. We also, I say that cautiously because we also haven't received our request for our Code Blue plan yet. And usually it's about this time that we receive that. So I don't think that's any sort of warning sign right now, but we haven't received that. So we're still waiting on the documentation that goes with that and instructs us. But that's, you know, that's currently where we're at with that.
Okay. Yeah. And when is the date that starts, Kit?
That typically, I believe, is September, around the middle of, the beginning of October, October 1st, I believe.
Okay.
Tom, did you want to add to that? Anything that I'm missing there? I saw that you had your hand up.
Yeah, just two things. The state actually stepped back, I guess, maybe from its commitment to fund Code Blue last winter, to fund it with state money, I should say. Though for last winter, the 100% reimbursement for Code Blue is actually being funded for most districts out of the CARES ESG funding. Mm-hmm. And as Kit said, we have not yet received any direction or hints as to whether that will be the case for this coming winter or whether, as in prior years, Code Blue will revert to state funding. The second thing I wanted to mention was the Code Blue services are in effect on any evening at any point during the year where the wind chill temperature is at 32 degrees or below. But in our county, we have we contract with St. John's Community Services to provide Code Blue services on every night once the weather is going to be predictably below that every day or very nearly every day of every week.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good to know. The Farmer's Almanac says it's going to be a very cold winter. So I've got Martha and then Henry.
Thank you, Deborah. And Kit and Tom, good to see you. Kit, you said that 3/4 of the mandate increases are due to Medicaid. But I thought we have a cap on the local share.
We do have a cap on the local share. What we're showing there, that 3/4, that 75% increase in our, I want to go back and look at it. That 75% increase, that we're showing is in our local cost. There is a Medicaid cap, but currently with the CARES Act money, that's been covering most of that EFMAP money. I'm going to turn this over to Tom because he's really our EFMAP expert. But yes. There is. Tom, do you want to speak to that?
I do. Martha, you're right that there is a cap on each local district's contributions. However, the way that the New York State Department of Health has interpreted that cap, the cap is on an annual basis, a calendar year basis, but New York State DOH calculates the amount that each district will owe on a state fiscal year basis. And then that has to get translated back to calendar years. For that reason, and also because the contributions that counties make are due on Tuesday of each week. In some quarters, there are more, and in some quarters, there are fewer weekly contributions. And so as a consequence of those two things, the amount that any given county would actually have to pay under the cap will fluctuate in most years from one year to the next. And over a cycle, sometimes of 2 years, sometimes over 4 or 5 years, it balances out. However, layered on top of that, so that's the state Medicaid cap. Layered on top of that is that subsequent to that state legislation being passed, the Affordable Care Act passed. And that enhanced federal reimbursement for the Affordable Care Act, and then more recently, the even more enhanced federal reimbursement under the CARES Act, have meant that counties are paying even less than their capped Medicaid contributions, which is great news, except that it makes it very difficult to predict how much we'll benefit from that going forward. So
right, because I now remember that the federal plus up related to COVID was supposed to end when? September 30th?
Well, I don't think there was a sunset on it, as far as I'm aware. What the federal government had committed to states was they would be approving that or extending that on a quarter by quarter basis, and that they would let states know, I believe it was 60 days in advance of the end of a quarter, if and when the CARES EF map was going to end. So at this point in time, we know that unless the federal government changes its mind, which, you know, it might if they can't raise their debt ceiling. At this point, under those promises made under the last administration, we are fully expecting that CARES derived EF map will continue through the end of this calendar year at least.
Okay. All right. It had to do with the federal declaration. And since we're still not out of the woods, they're maintaining
that has been extended continuously at this point, I believe, up through the end of the year.
Okay. So you're reminding me why the DSS budget needs, you know, an enormous amount of concentration just for us to absorb it. And Lisa, I love that you said yes to everything here. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Okay, thanks, Martha. So I've got Henry and then Mike Lyon.
Yes, thank you for the report, Kip. I was curious, how much do you expect to use the respite beds?
Well, it's a little hard to predict, Henry. One of the challenges really is that our whole landscape is changing with the family first legislation. That's really going to take us into territory that we have never encountered before. We in the past have really maintained a very low number of kids in congregate care. We in Tompkins County do a great job, frankly, because of your support largely, with prevention programs. So we avoid a lot of the more expensive intervention programs on the backside of that. There are many, many counties that have, you know, they basically, when kids are having trouble, they go to detention, and that costs a lot of money. So we do a lot more of on that preventive side. We have a lot of kids in foster care, and we have at this point a large percentage, about 50 to 60% of our kids in foster care are actually in kinship care, with family, so or kin like. Significant people in their lives. So that really minimizes the number of kids in care, in congregate care. However, the reality is that we know that either when kids are going to have to go into certain congregate settings
one of the things that this respite bed will help with is it's not as easy these days. You've probably heard me talk about this at other times. It's not as easy these days to get kids a placement. So when kids need to go into care, this bed will sometimes be an option, depending on the level of care needed. It may be an option to fill that gap when we're waiting for a care option, a care setting for the kid to go into. And like I said, it also is a great way to preserve care options, sometimes because kinship care is oftentimes a setting that kids have no idea, families have no idea that a kid's going to need to go in to a kinship setting. We just approach a family and say, hey, we've got a child that needs a placement. Can you take them? Lots of times when that happens, families need a little time to either figure out how they're going to do that, or they need a break periodically. So this will fill all of those gaps. What we don't know yet is how frequently, what is going to be the need? But this will guarantee us at least one bed. And I think we know from our experience right now that we anticipate that it probably will experience considerable use. We just don't know exactly at this point.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Mike Lane?
Hi, Kit, how are you? First of all, I just want to say, as Martha said, you're our largest department, and your budget is always hard for us to get wrap our minds around. But what a great job you folks and all of your 180 employee FTEs do for us and for the people of our community. We don't say that enough, but we think about it. And we want you to know we're kind of proud of your department.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mike.
Now I'm going to ask you a question that I just couldn't wait to ask. In fact, because I made a faux pas the other night by asking it to the wrong person. but when Lisa gave her budget presentation, she mentioned in her dashboard calculations that the safety net program, we were seeing an increase in the number of people there. And of course, I think we have to pay like 71% of that cost. I think she told us. My question is there anything we can do about the numbers in there or and maybe you're already doing it, but is there any way to try to bring those numbers down or put them onto other programs rather than to that kind of expensive local program?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I don't want to take up too much time, but this might be something that I talk to the committee or the legislature, however it might be requested at some point going into 2022 about. So I think you're familiar with the fact that there are limits that got set a number of years ago on how long a family can access TANF, right? The temporary assistance for needy families. So that's a 5-year or 60-month limit that people can access that. And after that, if people still need help and they are single individuals without children, then they go over to safety net funding, which, like you said, costs us a lot more. One of the programs that we are just getting up and running, so we're not even fully going with it, but we really have put a lot of work into our temporary assistance division coordinator, really, Adele Ayers really deserves all the credit around this. So she has been working for a while to get a new program started that would actually help with folks that are kind of long-term on safety net assistance. Lots of them, the reason that they are is because they can't meet the work requirements. They end up really having long-term kind of disability situations. It may be physical, it may be mental health, it may be substance abuse kinds of issues. And so one of the things that we're really looking at and that we've got a program designed for is that we would actually contract through the state with a group that would help us do assessments. So these people would be referred to assessments that would then help us determine how best to help them. And if they're going to be long-term disabled, then what we would do is help them, assist them in getting hooked up with Social Security disability insurance. This is a program that a lot of other counties have put into place, and it takes a while to really develop it, and it's a process to contract and then to be able to come up with a streamlined way to have people go through and get assessed and then help them. But that's something that has been underway this last year. We're just on the brink of putting that in place. It's a pretty exciting development for us. We don't have a way to really talk a lot. My light just turned off. We don't have a way to talk a lot about the outcome right now because we haven't fully put it in place, but that's where we're going. And I think it's going to significantly help both the clients who need the supports that come with that Social Security disability, but I think it's also we're going to see a reduction potentially in the expense associated with safety net. So more to come on that.
Well, that's great news. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. Are there any more questions? Oh, Martha, your hand's fading into your background. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Tom's answer got me so, like, I had to concentrate so hard, I forgot. I also wanted to ask about ERAP. How are we doing? Do you know how many people are actually getting funding? What's the, you know, are people, is the money flowing?
The money is flowing. The money is flowing. So I just literally as I was logging on, I got new figures that got sent to me. And what I can tell you is that for rental arrears in our county, we have 581 people that have applied. That doesn't mean they've all been approved, but that's our current number for our county. And in the utility arrears category, it's 116 people. There may be overlap between those two. We kind of get limited data when it comes to this program. And then for our prospective rent assistance, again, there may be crossover between the arrears and the prospective rent. We have 491 people that have applied. And the last time, and I'm sorry, Martha, that I don't have like the most current, but the last time I looked at the amount of money that had been dispersed, it was over $700,000 that have gone out to people in our county. Just so people know, if you're looking for more information, OTDA has really begun to release a tremendous amount more information on their website, and I'm putting that into the chat right now. I just uploaded that link, and there's just a lot more. I mean, some of it is county-based. It can be a little bit difficult to decipher exactly what they're saying, but you should be able to actually get some figures from there now that's a little more comprehensive than what I've been able to put out.
That's really helpful. That's great. Appreciate that. So if 700,000 or so has gone out, you have no way to know if all these people got approved and the funding was, you have no way to know.
We don't have a way. We don't have a way to know.
What I hate to interrupt this, but it really doesn't have a heck of a lot to do with your budget kit. So we're going to move on.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. So are there any other questions about Kit's budget? Not seeing any. We will wish her a lovely evening. Thanks again, Kit. It was a great presentation. And we will move on to the Office of Human Rights.
Thank you so much.
Ken Clark?
Yes, good evening. I am going to share my screen with you. Okay. There we are. And this, you'll notice in a change in the 2021 adopted and modified budgets in the 2022 target. And that change is related to a change made in our education and outreach position. Instead of that being a 40-hour position, we are projecting that to be a 20-hour position. After some assessment and some conversations with staff as well as with Lisa Holmes, we felt that the requirements for this position could be met within a 20-hour framework working in tandem with Carmen Arroyo, our staff assistant. So this revised position will be posted later in the fall, and we'll be circulating that through a number of venues in order to find a group of candidates to apply for this position. And this graph indicates the change in FTEs from the two prior years. I am also making an over-target request for $40,000. This request is targeted for education and outreach that would enable OHR to invite speakers of national reputation whose honoraria exceed $3,000. This would include, for example, the person addressing the keynote, or the person delivering that will deliver the keynote address for the 2022 Juneteenth celebration. OHR provided funding for this year's Juneteenth speaker, Dr. Scott Brown from UCLA. And it will also enable us to attract speakers of national reputation as part of our monthly program schedule. This OTR will enhance our program offerings to address significant human rights issues, while we also will continue to tap into the great local resources we've utilized over the past nearly 3 years. And so we want to do that in recognizing that, this is what it will take to sort of enhance our programming and to bring speakers of national repute to our local community, addressing issues of human rights and working in collaboration with other human services organizations, as well as the campuses as well. So those are the two most significant issues related to the OHR budget proposed for 2022.
Okay, is that it, Ken?
Yes.
All right, thank you. If you want to stop screen sharing, we can take any questions.
Sure.
Okay, I see Henry has a question.
Yes, Reverend Clark, thank you for the presentation. I was noticing that in other supplies, your budget went from $2,100 in 1999 to $900 in 2020, and then went up. Is that for honorariums too? Is that the reason why that number's been so?
For supplies?
Yeah, other supplies you have.
They are supplies that we have utilized for programming in the past, in terms of projection. I mean, it's as well as, office, general sort of office supplies and resources, but I mean, there have been some charges. I mean, I would have to look into the specifics to address that, I guess, more precisely. But that's, that would be my response.
Okay, thank you.
Mike Lane.
Thank you for your presentation. I just want to say I've been so impressed by the outreach that your department has been doing, particularly during the COVID and making programming more difficult. And I'd like to say thanks for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. We've tried to adapt to the sort of realities that, have prohibited us from scheduling in-person events, although I see that in some cases locally in places like Cornell, for example, there are some in-person events being scheduled now. But we've sought to be adaptable and and to find ways to reach the audiences that we've been trying to cultivate. And we'll continue to do so.
That's great.
Thanks, Ken. Martha?
Thanks, Deborah. Thank you, Ken, for the report. One of the key things the community had asked about in recent years was about the ability to file a complaint with the state office. Is that still something that you can do with the staff that you have, and how does that work?
Yes, that can be done with the staff we have. I mean, I'm the person who, you know, takes the inquiries, which come to us by phone, by walk-ins now that we have reopened the office, phone calls and such, emails, messages sent to our website. And we continue to, you know, take inquiries, and to the extent that we can, we try to address that problem by whatever issue or concern that people bring. Primarily the issues have to do with employment and housing, and enable, help them to file a complaint with the State Division of Human Rights. In other cases, we do referrals to other human service agencies that might be more appropriate for the issue that, or issues that they, that people are concerned about. So, we do have sufficient staff to be able to do that. And I have been, since 2018, been the primary person who has met with persons, about their, concerns and their alleged human rights, violations.
All right. So thanks. So that sounds like that's still moving ahead the way it's necessary and the community needs. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
All right then. Anything else for Ken? Looks like you're off the hook, Ken.
Oh, okay. It's good to be off the hook.
Yeah. I want to thank everybody who came tonight and stayed for the duration, our staff and legislative members and anybody who's a member of the public. And the Merry Band will reconvene Thursday night at 5:30. We'll see you then. 4:30, sorry.
4:30, okay.
And we will see you. Good night.
Night.
Good night, everybody.